Everybody, yeah. Welcome to another episode of Colonial Outcast. I just did that thing because I went for a run for like the first time in 8 months, and I have this like insane dopamine thing going on. I'm trying to get back in shape because I'm about to go on to a bunch of military podcasts, and like the first thing people are going to be like is like, dude, look how fat Greg is. So that just did that, and now we are coming into the studio, which means our respective apartments, which we record this podcast from, to talk about Civil War. So will the Israeli state survive to celebrate 100 years? So it's currently May 14th, Israel's Independence Day. And there's this whole mess of contention about its long-term existential survival. Will domestic fury and fierce civil strife cumber all the parts of Israel proper? Not to get all Shakespearean, but they do have a polarizing civil unrest problem on their hands. And statistics like, quote, 60% of Israelis believe the IDF isn't using enough force in Gaza, unquote, give us outsiders that mistaken impression that Israeli society is a monolithic, violent colonial entity instead of a multipolar violent colonial entity that is incidentally experiencing a period of unprecedented socio-cultural fragmentation. So today on Colonial Outcasts, we're going to wade into subjects of internecine violence, i.e. violence between different political blocs, parties, organizations in Israel, and the question of Palestinian statehood being recognized in the United Nations General Assembly. Actually, due to last-minute schedule changes, Alina, our now regular political analyst, had a thing. So Palestinian statehood will be part two, released tomorrow, the 15th. So we're just going to focus on the civil strife issue in Israel on this episode. But the two issues are very much connected. And today we're going to talk about that with Mark Wayne, who you know, who studied in Israel once upon another lifetime, about all this domestic madness and internal turmoil in Israel that we've touched on before, but largely glossed over in deference to the horror being enacted in Gaza. However, it is unavoidably relevant now. So, Mark, you feeling a little bit like Alice? Shall we go down this insane rabbit hole, talk about the divide between quote-unquote Israelis and Judeans?
Yeah, I feel good today doing that. I feel smart today for some reason. Like I got some brain cells left, so I'm down. Let's do this.
Well, yeah, I mean, you also you studied in Israel, and we'll get into that. And you know, you've hung out with both sides of the divide and witnessed it firsthand. So this will be kind of your wheelhouse, and I'll be the interviewer for the most part. But to dive right in, without further ado, and intersect the conversations of civil strife in Israel and Palestinian statehood in the UN, which will hit tomorrow, we're going to look at an article published recently in Haaretz by former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who served as the 12th Prime Minister of Israel from 2006 to 2009, and break it down real quick to contextualize the following discussion. Okay, so this was published about 24 hours ago in Israeli media, Haaretz, which is kind of, would you describe Haaretz as more of a left-wing? I mean, there is no left wing in Israel, but more of a left wing publication insofar as one exists in Israel. Yeah.
Yeah, most definitely. If you talk to anybody who's on the right in Israel and you mention Haaretz, they'll be like, ah, it's a liberal article. That's a liberal publication, which is hilarious because they're not that liberal or left by our definition. But for Israeli definitions, it's very left wing.
Yeah. And I would like to say I've been reading Haaretz, or however you pronounce it. I'm never going to get it right.
Haaretz means Haaretz means the land. It's the mythological invocation of the land of the Holy Land. So Haaretz.
Oh, okay. Haaretz. Okay. So
meaning the Eretz is the land. Is the land.
Oh, look at you. Got it. Someone studied over there.
A little bit.
Okay. So I've been reading this publication since before October 7th. And never once have I come across an article or an op-ed where any writer, either doing reporting or editorializing, has in any real or material way acknowledged the suffering of the Palestinians. That's just an observation I've had. So it's left wing, but they're still like not recognizing the humanity of, you know, a significant part of their population. So anyways, This is written by a former Israeli prime minister, published a couple days ago, and it's written on the eve of Israeli Independence Day. So the title is The Gaza War's Final Scene and Beyond. This is what Israel's endgame should be. So to begin, he writes, these days there are growing voices, including my own, calling for ending the war now. Okay, that's a little bit of sanity. Don't worry, guys, I'm going to editorialize this whole thing.
A little bit 7 months too late, but yeah.
Months too late. The practical significance of stopping the war in Gaza at this point lies in reaching a deal that would include the return of all the hostages, living or dead. In tandem, Israel will have to agree in a binding manner to withdraw from the entire Gaza Strip, returning to the border from which it set out on its ground maneuver over 6 months ago. Calling what happened as in Gaza a ground maneuver is very quite optimistic and rosy, but
got it. Ground maneuver now equals bulldozing over children, sniping kids in their kneecaps, yeah, and starving them. Got it. Ground maneuver.
So I do like how he's recognizing that the only way to get the hostages back is through a deal. That's cool. And then he writes, in fact, the war actually ended 3 months ago. Okay, first of all, I would say the war kind of ended in November. That some people would say they lost the war on October 7th because they lost the war the second people started understanding the plight of the Palestinians in the global context. But only two combat brigades remain in Gaza, which is true, out of the massive force unprecedented in its scale of 28 brigades, in addition to air power, drones, helicopters, and jet planes that were there at the peak of operations. So like, yeah, now that we've seen Rafah kicking off, he's correct. There's only two brigades, you know, a few thousand infantrymen left in all of Gaza. And what they're doing is like limited mechanized raids and patrols, mostly in Rafah, but some in North and South Gaza, in places that they were already supposed to have cleared of Hamas, but it's all lies. They haven't done any of that. They haven't reduced Hamas's capabilities in any substantial way. And most of these brigades are securing the Wadi Gaza, the corridor, the Netzvarim corridor that separates North and South Gaza, and they're securing the Philadelphia crossing between Rafah and Egyptian Sinai to stop aid from coming in. So that's where most of the people are. Then they're doing some performative little mechanized infantry raids in the rest of Gaza. But yeah, he's right. They don't have the manpower to do really anything, to hold ground, to secure objectives. So it's kind of a holding action. So,
break down what a brigade is?
A brigade, we've been trying to figure out
the Israeli definition of brigade,
but I was in a regiment in the military, which is different from a brigade. I'm going to have to do this real quick. Yeah, a brigade consists of a few battalions. So there's an infantry platoon, three infantry platoons go into a company, three companies or four companies go into a battalion, four battalions go into brigade. So it's like 3,000 to 5,000 soldiers. So there's probably around like 10,000 soldiers max in Gaza, but it's probably far less than that. Yep. So, when he says that the war is over, yeah, this is all performative. This is a low intensity holding action because they've been defeated, but they can't declare defeat. So anyways, moving on, there is no reason to pretend that the war continues. It's over. Preparations must now be made from withdrawing from Gaza Strip while handing control over to a multinational force. This is something we're going to talk about tomorrow. A multinational force, that's composed of soldiers from Arab armies, including Palestinians who are faithful to the Palestinian Authority. So this includes soldiers from Egypt. This is what the Israeli definition of a coalition force.
That's like zero Palestinians then, basically. Because I haven't met a single Palestinian that's loyal to the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that. So this includes like soldiers from Egypt, Jordan, the UAE, Bahrain, and he says, hopefully Saudi Arabia. And that's very telling because Saudi Arabia is, you know, totally try to normalize with Israel and is the United States' closest ally. So it's not just him. They've been advocating for this like multilateral coalition force of Arab states to have this composite security control over Gaza because Israel wants it under their thumb, but they can't be seen to do that. So they want a bunch of strategic allies to the U.S., like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, to a certain extent, that's in a bad, a difficult political position, to help out with their coalition and give them legitimacy. Also, the Palestinian Authority, again, as Mark said, no one's really a fan of that, because the Palestinian Authority collaborates with the Israeli occupation of West Bank. They give them intelligence information on Palestinian citizens, and they help with arrests and do all that other stuff. Is that an incorrect assessment?
No, that's very correct. And I think a good analogy or parallel to the relationship between Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority would be, if you guys look back at the Wounded Knee Massacre that happened in the 1970s, not the old Wounded Knee Massacre, but the 1970s between in Standing Rock at the Native American Reservation, the Native Americans had an uprising against their council because they found out that their council members were simply puppets for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So that's, in my opinion, I've done, you know, in looking past in history, it's the best parallel I've seen so far. So look up the 1970s revolt and the Wounded Knee Massacre with the Native Americans, and there you go. That's a perfect parallel between the Palestinians' relationship with the PA. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and then Omert in this article keeps talking about this contingency force of coalition armed soldiers, you know, accompanied by a statement of its willingness to embark on negotiations over a peace agreement with the Palestinians. These will be represented by an upgraded Palestinian Authority fortified with people who are able to lead it with resolve and continue to cooperate with Israel on security matters in the West Bank, saying the quiet part out loud that they are collaborators.
Yeah, translation on that, it's people who are willing to be Israel's bitch.
Yeah, Mahmoud Abbas, he has been doing that for over 18 years. And I was talking to some people in the West Bank recently. Apparently, he doesn't go out. He just travels from the government building back to his house in like an armed convoy because he's just like not welcome anywhere.
Yeah, it's that bad, guys. It's that bad.
So obviously, the condition for this whole plan is an immediate agreement to the return of all hostages. Anyone who thinks that it's possible to return them without a clear and total cessation of war is deluding themselves and the Israeli public. Such a person is also deluding the hostages' families. Yeah. There's been a bunch of protests about bring the hostages back. Stop the violence so we can get the hostages back. It has nothing to do with the Palestinians, but that is a salient point that Israelis are starting to listen to and really respond to and protest against. So he says, I've said in the past and repeat that there is, without any doubt or hesitation, Prime Minister Netanyahu is deliberately and knowingly foiling any chance of reaching such a deal. We've known this since October. They don't want the hostages back. They murder the hostages. And as someone with a background in that kind of world, I was never involved in hostage rescue stuff, but I know about it on a basic fundamental level. You only actually go in to try to retrieve hostages militarily if diplomatic negotiations or ransoms fail, because that's really the only way to get hostages back. Because usually it doesn't matter if you're freaking Delta Force. Usually when a hostage rescue operation happens, it's the last resort because the hostages are going to die. So
yeah, and what's funny is whenever the media talks about the hostage situation, they never bring up or invoke the Hannibal Directive. It's like it doesn't exist. It's like the entire directive is not a thing. It's only after you probe them on what the Hannibal Directive is that they actually explain what the fuck it is, which is basically saying that hostages, liability, don't need them, get rid of them while you have a chance before they wind up in enemy hands and use as a bargaining chip.
Yeah, and if you're not familiar yet, the Hannibal Directive is essentially this doctrine that's supposed to no longer exist anymore, but it definitely still exists, that if an Israeli citizen or soldier is going to be captured, just light them all up, captives or hostage and hostage takers, so they don't have the political mess of having to negotiate with quote-unquote terrorists and rescue their own hostages. So just kill them all, let God sort them out type thing. We saw that with the Nova Festival of Apache helicopters shooting at everybody, 40-millimeter rockets into civilian vehicles. That's, you know, why you see that entire blown out car lot in the Nova Festival. Hannibal Directive in practice. We have eyewitness reports of Israeli tanks shooting shell tank rounds into kibbutz where there were civilians. Hannibal Directive. It might no longer exist on paper, but it's actively being enacted on the ground.
Now, go back to that collection of cars that we saw. I remember not to get amnesia, but I remember that when that scene, those scenes first came out, the narrative was what? What was the narrative on that? That, you know, Qassam fighters blocked the road and committed the massacre with their AK-47s. But you look at the foot. Now, when I saw the photographs, I'm like, there's no way ground fighters with AK-47s could have done that damage. It had to have been a lot heavier of weaponry, like, you know, Vulcan cannons or, you know, 50 caliber machine guns. So, but at the time, those images were the emotional, that was the emotional push for Western audiences that saw that to be down for whatever proceeded after that in Gaza. So just footnote, go ahead.
Yeah. And so he, it says that it's customary to say that Netanyahu certainly wants to bring the hostages back and is posing conditions that appear reasonable to many Israelis, but you know, Hamas will never accept any of his conditions because they don't need to. As you know, the former prime minister has said, they've already won. Israel's already lost the war. The war is over. And it's clear, it's incongruent with Netanyahu's personal needs. You know, Netanyahu needs to keep this going. We've talked about this ad nauseum. He's up on corruption charges. He's scared about fallout in the global forum. And as long as this keeps going, he maintains his emergency powers as prime minister to keep acting and surviving existentially in a political sense. So then we come to it. Quote, if God forbid the UN General Assembly decides to recognize the existence of a Palestinian state, it's clear that this state would be recognized outside of Israel's May 1967 borders. From that point on, Palestinians will refuse to negotiate with Israel and will make do with demanding that Israel be forced to implement this decision, a demand that will be brought before the UN. So we're going to get more into this tomorrow about what the UN is, but if Palestinian statehood is recognized by the United Nations, Israel will be in an even more difficult political situation when it comes to making demands and force-feeding policy on the Palestinians, because either the United States will have to support the UN, which is its post-World War II baby, this liberal institution that's meant to project its power across the globe, and if it subverts the UN decision, which it created and which it benefits from, then it's kind of shooting itself in the foot with regards to these global power structures it's created. So they're actually very worried about Palestinian statehood. So more on that next time. But
well, the language here obviously indicates the bias of higher ed's. If God forbid, Palestinians have a state. So that tells you where they stand.
Yeah. And again, this is a very left wing.
Yeah. Very liberal article here.
Yeah. So this is not a delusional assessment. The issue is on the agenda of a significant number of countries. Yeah, most countries at this point want to recognize Palestinian statehood so they don't get even more and more isolated from the global community. But under these circumstances, I'm often asked what the odds are that Israel will reach an understanding internally. And this is what our episode is about. That such a move will involve a withdrawal from the bulk of the territories conquered by Israel. Is that even possible? The evacuation of 100,000 Israelis? Practical? I believe that a diplomatic resolution would leave Israel in possession of 4.4% of the West Bank, will allow leaving a large portion of settlers in place. But it's not about how many settlers there are. It's about the fact that settlers are woven in between the ghettoized Palestinian communities, which makes freedom of movement impractical. Yeah,
impractical. It's like they say that the West Bank looks like Swiss cheese now with all the different pop-ups of...
Well, you know, Ariel Sharon said, quote, we're going to make a pastrami sandwich out of them. So, you know, no one can force us to withdraw.
Oh, pastrami sandwich. It does look a little more like a pastrami sandwich now that I think about it.
I know. Areas that would be annexed to Israel include a large portion of the people considered residents of the territories, thus transferring the rest of the settlers from areas that will be evacuated to areas that are retained and annexed. Okay, so basically, the big crux of this problem of Palestinian statehood is not just ideological; it's practical. Like all of these settlers who tend to be more conservative, they're the ones holding the guns. They're the ones who get off on this wild west, come from America on this to have this wild west cowboy fantasy where they're, you know, frontiersmen, you know, putting down the native population, carrying their guns, have gun, will travel, and they tend to be more conservative. So they're definitely going to have a problem with that. So
these were mostly the kids who were bullied in high school back in the early 90s. So this is their way of getting back at the world.
And, you know, we believe that there's already a considerable part of the Israeli public that will oppose a decision to withdraw from West Bank, which, you know, if Palestinian statehood is recognized, will become a like the biggest point of political and international political pressure, I believe. And we're concerned about violent resistance that could lead to clashes and bloodshed, not between Palestinians, but potentially between Israelis and Israeli police forces. So the hundreds of thousands of weapons distributed by National Security Minister Ben-Gvir to anyone wishing to possess one could turn out to be weapons, quote, used in a violent civil war waged by extremist messianic Jews who don't recognize the legitimacy of the government's decision, assuming there is such a government, and that this is its decision to withdraw from, quote, areas of the homeland. So he goes on to say, is it possible to conceive that some military units, especially those composed of numerous settlers, graduates of religious pre-military academies, such as the one settlement Eli, will see themselves as duty-bound to oppose orders from their commanders to implement such a withdrawal? So he's kind of alluding to a potential military coup or military internecine fighting between different military commanders, their troops, the troops that are loyal to them, and a dissolution of the entire military continuity of the chain of command and integrity thereof. Mm-hmm. So he says, God forbid again, will it turn out, God forbid, that some commanders share the feeling that in order to evacuate the territories is illegitimate, a betrayal of the Jewish people's values and of the sanctity of the land? So, I think then he goes on. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to go back to the weapons thing. So a little known fact about the weapons distribution amongst the settlers is that a few years prior to now, there was a mass disarming of the kibbutzim that were along the southern region near Gaza, the one that was attacked on October 7th, right? So the mass disarmament of those kibbutzim was, now mind you, those kibbutzim are more on the liberal side of Israeli society. So there was an intentional disarming of those communities, which were then distributed to the more violent settlers up north. Right, leaving, paving the way for, you know, the a lot of the events that took place on October 7th, where these kibbutzim were left unarmed to protect themselves. This was very intentional because, like I said, the kibbutzim were more on the liberal side of society. So, with the finessing of Ben-Gvir and a few other players, disarming those communities who were more liberal and distributing them to the more violent, fanatical Jewish settlers of the West Bank, it created this interesting dynamic of one side of Israeli society being heavily armed, the other liberal side of society being heavily disarmed. You know, so anyways, footnote, go ahead.
Yeah. Will not an insignificant number of police officers who already appear eager to employ violence in service of Ben-Gvir obey orders to enforce a withdrawal from areas belonging to the homeland? Will these police officers who watch settler violence against Palestinians stand on the sidelines, let it happen, protect the settlers doing the violence, enforce an order to remove by force those same settlers? So that's the point of concern he's bringing up right now.
And it's a very, very plausible concern because it's happening right now. The same violence is happening while, like you said, cops and IDF are providing cover.
Yeah. So it seems to me that the policy of incitement, the pitting of different groups against one another, the sowing of division and tearing up of Israeli society, a policy led by Netanyahu for years as a means of consolidating support for himself while retaining power, has created the possibility of a violent confrontation that will rip society apart and topple its regime, shattering its democratic nature and leading to the demise of the country that has existed for 76 years, serving as a source of pride to its citizens and the many who love it around the globe. The many who love it around the globe are drastically diminishing quickly and rapidly.
So
he says, we are fighting on the military front with an imposing cooperation between reservists and conscript soldiers from all walks of life. He mentions Ashkenazi, Mizrahi Jews, religious and secular ones, Bedouin, you know, but outside the battlefield, there's this false image of unity with those who are now attempting to upend their democratic way of life, so he calls it, who are now attempting people who tomorrow may be at the forefront of the battle, holding weapons the current government has placed in their hands in a reckless and irresponsible move, fighting anyone who is unwilling to live in a state that occupies and persecutes another people with another religion in areas that are not meant to be part of Israel. Okay,
that, part surprises me that they put that in there. Meanwhile, yeah. Saying, God forbid there's a Palestinian state, but also, so I'm really confused at this author's, you know, ethos, you know? So anyway.
I don't really know, but you know, when he mentions like all of these people, Ashkenazi, Mizrahi, religious and secular Jews, or we could say Zionists, it's like, what we're seeing right now is the only thing that really ties them together is this fear of and hatred of like the Arabs. Like that's their only commonality. So before we get into talking about Israelis and Judeans, he finishes up by saying everything must be done to mobilize demonstrators and get them on the streets in order to do everything possible to remove from our lives not just the leader of this fundamentalist radical camp, but also the ones who are even now using violence to stop the families of the hostages and those opposed to the government. So, we're starting to see this massive societal fragmentation, and the only through line is hatred of the Arabs, and most typified by hatred of the Palestinians. That's why across all these different blocks and societies and groups of people, these political organizations, everybody agrees, you know, we could use more force in Gaza, but like, yay Netanyahu, yay Ben-Gvir, or, you know, screw those guys. So I wanted to bring up one thing that's mentioned in all of these editorials coming out on Israeli Independence Day. It's this idea of a differentiation between Israelis and Judeans. And from my layman's understanding, Israelis are kind of the colloquial term for the liberals, the coastal elite who live in Tel Aviv.
The metropolitan,
like New York. If they were living in the East Coast, they'd like read the New Yorker and, you know, talk all the shit about MAGA world and like love Joe Biden. And then you have the people in the settlers, like the settlers, the Judeans, the ultra religious right, far right, sometimes Orthodox settler people who carry the guns and are base their legitimacy off of scripture and stuff like that. And they are not secular like the Tel Avivians. So could you tell us more about that divide?
Yeah. So when I lived there, like I said, I was embedded in both of those groups. I would hang out with the ultra Orthodox, completely Zionist, nationalistic religious fanatics, and I'd hang out with the completely metropolitan liberals, you know? So you got the Tel Aviv lifestyle, which is your, like I said, it's your, they focus more on, you know, living a liberal lifestyle with, you know, focusing on innovation, while at the same time also being Israeli supremacist. Whereas you have the Judeans, which, like you said, are the religious fanatics who are focused on Jewish supremacy, right? So you have Israeli supremacy and you have Jewish supremacy. So like the Judeans are more specifically focused on Jewish supremacy, you know? So what's interesting is that, like you said, both of them share the commonality of hating the Arabs, hating the Palestinians as an existential threat. Like, for example, the seculars believe they're an existential threat to Israeli society, democratic liberal society, or what they perceive as being a liberal democratic society. Whereas the Judeans focus more on the outside world being an existential threat to Judaism. And what I mean by Judaism, I'm not talking about the liberal Judaism that a lot of Americans follow, but the fanatical messianic era, you know, pipe dream form of Judaism, like very deep into the worst parts of the Talmud, basically, you know. So I wanted to talk about, in order to talk about this societal structure, you cannot talk about without talking about what I call the Israeli pyramid of moral culpability. So it's basically a pyramidal structure in the Israeli power structure where powerful individuals at the top, driven solely by the greed of outside investors, i.e. American and British banks, BlackRock military industries, and devoid of any ideology, issue orders to those below them who are useful idiots. So the middle tier is convinced that the top by the top that they are serving a noble mission, carries out these orders with zeal, often engaging in evil actions under the guise of a great ideology, i.e. radical settlers thinking that they're bringing back the coming of a messianic age of Jewish supremacy. In turn, the middle group passes down orders to the lower tier, which is motivated by a more positive altruistic belief, unaware of the true nature of the hierarchy's intentions. So this would be secular Israelis at the lower tier who are very nationalistic for Israel. They're not into the fanatical, you know, messianic vision like Ben Gavir and his crew. So they're more focused on just the preservation of Israeli society and democracy. But they all share a common uniting paranoia, the paranoia that the Palestinians are the boogeyman there to destroy everything that Israel stands for, you know. And this is the main narrative that's painted, then pushed on to Americans, American public via the media, you know, right-wing groups in the United States. So you have this pyramid that you have to understand. Bibi Netanyahu, no ideologies. He has no loyalties to his own people. He's simply the puppet for the military-industrial complex and outside interests like BlackRock. But what's useful to him, though, are the religious fanatics like Ben Gavir's crew that will carry out his orders with loyalty because in their minds, they're carrying out the greater vision of a messianic period of the Jewish supremacy. They're all getting played. They're all getting played.
Right. But what's ironic about that is because they've gained so much supremacy and power, like Ben Gavir, Smotrich, Bibi Netanyahu is now beholden to them for his own power. So they've said, like, if he accepts a ceasefire deal, they'll leave government. And then there goes his massive religious far right power block that he relies on.
Which is okay, which is fine for him, as long as he's able to accomplish a few goals before that happens, right? Mm-hmm. So Bibi Netanyahu knows that the people he's going to be losing loyalty very soon from the fanatics below him. That's okay because he got done what he needed to get done in Gaza, which was clearing it out, making way for possible real estate investments, you know, get the extraction of gas, whatever fucked up plans they have for Gaza. Netanyahu was able to use his useful idiots just in the nick of time to get that accomplished. After it falls apart, like you're saying, it's going to be okay for him because he's going to be, you know, probably expelled, go to a nice vacation home in the Bahamas. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Point is, he used the idiots to their full capacity. When things go south on him, he's not sweating it because he knows he already has an exit plan. That's my personal take on things.
Okay.
Yeah.
So eventually a lot of people are concerned it's going to come to a head, which is why if we pull up like the screen, all of these articles were published on Haaretz. We've got Will Israel Survive to Celebrate 100 Years? This Independence Day, Israel has split into two incompatible Jewish states. Like, a lot of people are talking about American polarization. Like, we've never been this polarized since the Civil War, but no one's saying like there's going to not any serious publication is talking about an American Civil War, about sectarian violence cropping up, you know, between like MAGA world and the liberals and like the leftists and the anarchists and stuff. So it's striking to me that this is like a conversation in what's arguably mainstream media, especially on Independence Day of all things.
And it's so frustrating for me to see it because, okay, and I'm going to bitch a little bit and I'm going to gloat a little bit at the same time. So because of all the gaslighting that has been done since the beginning of, you know, the past 7 months, I feel the urge to gloat. Where when I'm right about something, I want to reverse the gaslighting and be like, I fucking told you so. I've been telling people that there's going to be a disintegration of Israeli society way back before they even invaded Gaza. And the reason why I thought that, the reason why I was telling people that, and a lot of people thought that that's never going to happen. The Israelis are more united than ever. I heard that on both sides. I heard that from Zionists and I heard that from the pro-Palestinian side. I was laughing because I'm like, you guys do not understand Israeli society. They're not united like the Palestinians are. The Palestinians truly are like one organism in a sense that they have such a tight-knit indigenous community that it, whatever happens to one Palestinian happens to all of them. Israelis are more self-cannibalistic. Like, there's a lot, like these fanatics in the Israeli government, they have no problem seeing Israelis die if it accomplishes a greater nationalist goal. Whereas Palestinians don't have that mentality. And I said, if you have a society like that, when rubber meets the road and shit really gets down to the wire, they're going to turn on each other. And you combine that with the psychological trauma that these soldiers coming back from Gaza after watching their fellow soldiers massacre children, that's going to work on their brain. So when they're in normal Israeli society, say in Tel Aviv, and they snap, it can get really violent really quick. And we've already seen that. We've already seen incidents of active shootings, clashes. It's just a matter of time before that heat starts to the microwave starts to heat up that egg, and then boom, it's gonna happen. So I've been telling people this for a while, and we're finally seeing it in official articles like we're reading right now.
Yeah, and I think that's why they're so scared of Palestinian statehood, because they'll finally have to make it a conversation. Mm. They'll finally have to curb settler violence. There's been some performative action by the Biden administration that he like sanctioned 5 settlers. He sanctioned them a few months ago, and that's it. But they've never had to do anything. So the U.S. will eventually have to choose between supporting Israel unconditionally, its little colonial project on the Eastern Mediterranean, or backing UN decisions, which the UN is its liberal institution that the U.S. uses to project global influence throughout the world. So it's going to have to make a choice between the two. So I think personally, I think it's going to have to concede somewhat to the UN, and Israel's not going to like that. And Israel will be compelled politically eventually to curb this settler violence, move some settlements. And that is the flashpoint for the civil war that we're talking about.
No, exactly. And when I arrived in Israel, I arrived in Israel in 2005. 2005, the day I arrived was the day that was the official day of the disengagement out of Gaza, when they were moving the settlers out of Gaza. So that was somewhat of a flashpoint. The Israeli society thought it was going to be a lot more violent than it turned out to be. It wasn't, but it could have been. Now, those were under fairly green pastures of days, right? Mm-hmm. Today, completely different scenario. And not to mention, I wanted to point out the fact that a lot of what we call the metropolitan side of Israelis, the secular Israeli society, the Tel Aviv side of Israeli society, mind you, these people like to travel. They want to live the yoga, international, kumbaya lifestyle, going to India, meditating, hanging out and partying in places like Berlin and Paris. Well, now that the entire world is completely aware of Israel's injustices more than ever, and Israelis they're on the naughty list. So a lot of these liberal Israelis are frustrated that the actions of the Israeli state has really fucked up their party life outside of Israel. Now that bitterness is going to be directed inward towards the most extremist fanatical side. And we're going to see a lot of, flipping that, the fanatical religious Judean side of Israeli society, they hate the Israeli liberal society because they see them as a hindrance to the messianic period from coming. They consider them just like Jewish trash that they could completely sacrifice at any time. They have no qualms about getting rid of the parts of their society that they deem to be not fanatical or religious enough. If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and it's just becoming increasingly polarized. And yeah, it's not 2005 anymore. This is a much more violent world. We're seeing a colonial project kind of do its extinction burst, where all conversation has failed. There's no attempt at diplomacy. What's worked in the past isn't working, so they keep trying to make it work, and they keep trying harder and doubling down and using force, but force isn't working. That's going to come back and boomerang on their own internal politics and their own internal political parties and citizens as well. So, it's a completely different time than 2005 when the settlers were forced and compelled to move out of Gaza.
Yeah, now, in 2005, when I say that I was embedded in both sides of that Israeli society, so for example, I would go to yeshivas in Jerusalem, very fanatical religious yeshivas. And the way that they talked about the Tel Aviv side of Israel was very, I mean, it was very condescending. It was as if they did not even consider them as fellow Israelis. It was a complete disdain for each other. Flipping that talk, hanging around and partying with, liberal Jews and liberal Israelis in Tel Aviv, they look down on the fanatics as just being, a cult in a just probably the most fringe part of their society that they saw as crazy. But they didn't take them seriously enough. And I bet you back in 2005, if I were to tell them, hey, in 2023, they're going to be ruling, they wouldn't have believed me. So this was 2005. Imagine how much that's escalated since then, that divide,
Oh, yeah. And like we're seeing a little bit of that in America. Like Trump's going to come back in probably. Yeah. And like if you ask me when I identified as a liberal in like 2012, would Trump ever be president? Not just once, but twice. I'd be like, ha, you're crazy. Look what happened. So,
yeah.
Before we start wrapping up and kind of bridge the gap between the potential civil strife and civil violence that might happen in Israel that will be exacerbated by the UN potentially recognizing Palestinian statehood on May 21st. I wanted to just give some context for those viewers and listeners who are interested in the first civil war. And it wasn't a civil war of like Zionist v. Zionist, but it was a civil war within the nascent state of Israel in what, 1948?
Yeah. So you want me to read that? My first attempt.
Oh yeah. Mark wrote a synopsis for us about this first civil war going on. And we would like to just touch on it before we kind of expand on this looming civil conflict in the coming days. So it's completely different political context, but it's still relevant in some ways. So send it, Mark. This is the first Israeli civil war in 1948.
Yeah, Greg is the master of short form content. I am not, but per his challenge, I'm going to take a shot at it.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
Oh yeah. All right. So the causes and events surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian flashpoint of 1948 are some of the most argued and contested in the historical arguments between Zionists and pro-Palestinians. By my estimation, however, the entire cause can come down to terrorism. Terrorism not by Palestinians, but from Zionists, which I'll explain later. Due to heavy Zionist influence in Western bottlenecks of media for the past half century, the mainstream narrative of the civil war in Palestine that led to the 1948 war has been a both sides ism of portrayal of blame as to who was the original aggressor, if not the blame being on savage anti-Semitic Arabs attacking defenseless Jewish communities who are just trying to live in peace. However, as the media outlets are becoming increasingly decentralized and more objective historical accounts are getting more oxygen, the public has at last accumulating a more accurate picture of causality. Now, to be very reductive and explain the timeline of this, it starts with Britain trying to figure out how to facilitate a mass migration of European Jews into Palestine while maintaining administrative control and calm between Zionist terrorist groups embedded in mostly peaceful Jewish populations, simply grateful to have escaped European anti-Semitism, and the native Palestinians who are now increasingly terrified that this new European supremacist-driven terrorism is now becoming the de facto reality of their neighborhood. This control ultimately falls apart due to the increasingly horrific terrorist attacks directed at the British by three main terror groups, the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi, all of which are the forefathers of the current regime of Israel to this day. The British, not having the interest or morale to control such a volatile situation and desperate to clutch what few pearls the empire had left, handed the problem over to the UN, which takes us to the UN partition plan of November 29th, 1947. The United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 181, proposing the partition of Palestine into separate Jewish and Arab states. The reductive narrative has always been that the Jewish community accepted the plan while the Palestinian community and neighboring Arab states rejected it, just because they were mean anti-Semites. However, this narrative fails to mention that the Jewish community made up only 32% of the region's total population, but would be getting 56% of the land, while the Palestinians made up 68% of the region's population would only be getting 43% of the land. That misfortunate part of the deal is yet overshadowed with a bigger problem. The leading government of the Jewish community would be essentially ran by leadership from the three terrorist groups, which just drove the British to making such a desperate move of pushing this problem to the UN. If the entire British Empire was not able to cope with violence of Zionist terrorism, the simple question remains, how could the poorly funded and poorly defended Palestinians be expected to? So following the UN's decisions, violence erupted between Jewish and Palestinian communities. Initially, it was characterized by sporadic attacks and retaliations, but soon escalated into organized military operations. Now, the original three legacies of violence, Haganah, Irgun, and Lehi, in a very short time span, evolved from being a menacing terror cell within hiding within Jewish communities to now being fully equipped and outfitted small militaries, funded and armed by European and U.S.-based Zionists, and even Joseph Stalin himself. Foreign arms purchases alone were $28 million, which adjusted for inflation would equate to $1.7 billion today. By comparison, the Arab Higher Committee's total budget at this time amounted to $2.3 million, which adjusted for inflation equates to about $33 million today. We'll come back to this point later. In retaliation, the Arab Higher Committee led the Palestinian Arab response, coordinated with various Arab militias and volunteers from neighboring Arab countries, including the Arab Liberation Army and other local forces. Concurrently, the Zionist terrorist groups were formulating Plan Dalit, or Plan D. Dalit is the letter D in the Hebrew alphabet, which officially was a strategic blueprint aimed at securing Jewish control of the areas that could be snatched away from the Palestinians. But ultimately, was the logistical plan of ethnic cleansing, also known as the Nakba, with the sole purpose of expelling Palestinian populations to areas where Zionists could strategically repress and control Palestinians in a supremacist engineering of demographics, economy, and geographical theft. This resulted in the displacement of roughly 750,000 Palestinians from lands which were respectively preserved by families going back centuries. Key operations under Plan Dalit included Operation Nachshon. This operation aimed to break the siege of Jerusalem and secure supply routes to the city and marked a significant shift to offensive tactics by Jewish forces. The Deir Yassin massacre, where Irgun and Lehi terrorists attacked the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin, killing over 100 villagers. The events caused widespread panic amongst Palestinians that led to a diaspora of Palestinians fleeing to neighboring Arab states, and hundreds of thousands being forced to flee into the Gaza Strip, where entire bloodlines of these refugees are completely being wiped out as we record this podcast. The Tantura massacre, which we'll post a link in the documentary, in the description, after the capture of the village of Tantura by Alexandroni Brigade, reports indicate that between 70 to 200 Palestinian men were executed, but it actually included the rape, torture, and massacres of children as well. It's a very good documentary. I encourage everybody to watch it. It's completely laid out as far as interviews. You know, the Lida massacre or Lod massacre during Operation Danny, Israeli forces entered the town of Lida, where they killed hundreds of civilians. Subsequent expulsion of 50,000 to 70,000 Palestinian residents.
So if we look at all like the massacres on top of each other, it's horrific.
It's a lot.
It would go on forever. So
yeah. So Lehi massacre, the Sasa massacres.
That's exactly the genesis of the civil war, what it's called. But it was in between Palestinians and Israelis. Now, I think what's pertinent about that is that some of these terrorist groups, the Lehi, the Irgun, the Stern, they were kind of rogue actors for a minute, right? They were the ultra militarized. Were they religious at all? Were they Orthodox or like fanatical?
Yeah, it was a mixture. So it was kind of like a coalition force of secular Zionist, white supremacist people who just, you know, a lot of Europeans who just hated Arabs, and then you had the religious fanatics. So it was essentially a coalition of the most evil. Now, officially, yes, they were rogue. Unofficially, it kind of depends on your definition of rogue. If by rogue you mean being financed by very powerful individuals in Europe and the United States, I mean, yeah.
That's what I was going for, because
yeah,
could you draw a parallel then between the genesis of these terror organizations as being kind of rogue, but also well-funded and kind of like tongue-in-cheek, like, you guys do what you got to do, and we'll turn the other, you know, see no evil to these current settlers in the West Bank.
The only parallel I can think of, the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. I mean, as they're rogue, a bunch of rogue CIA guys who just said, hey, let's go to Cuba and overtake the country. And they, I mean, so.
No, but I was meaning like between like the Ergun and the Stern and the settler violence in West Bank. Like, these settlers seem kind of uncontrollable.
Yeah. No. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So the settlers being completely armed by Ben Gavir, who's a mystery of home of security or of the national security, right?
Uh-huh.
being one of the most powerful offices in the government of Israel, arming the settlers, celebrating with the settlers of a dead baby, a dead Palestinian baby that was burned alive. Not very rogue. I mean, pretty much a direct pipeline from them to an official government official. That's one of the most powerful government officials in the state of Israel. So,
yeah. So, I mean, that's just one glaring parallel I see between these early nascent organizations in 1948 during the Nakba and these settlers. So, in the Stern and the Ergun, they also attacked Israelis, and they attacked the British, and they attacked the authorities that were essentially telling them, hey, stop it. Is that correct?
That's correct. Even to the point that some of the British soldiers were so pissed off about the sheer cruelty that these terrorist groups were imposing on the British, that they, I believe 200 British soldiers actually joined the Palestinians ranks to fight against the Israelis as a result of simple revenge for getting back at the atrocities committed against the British by these, you know, terror cells, essentially.
So, I mean, it's weird how kind of the origins predict the destiny, right? There's some similarities I'm seeing right now. And that's the main concern that we, to circle back to the article that we broke down earlier.
The Ergun, the Haganah, and the Lehi, these are not considered like a shameful past in Israeli society. These settlers revere the old days. In fact, they invoke the old beautiful memories of when they can just massacre a village and with impunity. So these groups are romanticized. They're not looked upon in shame in a lot of Israeli society. So, you know.
Yeah, they kind of remind me of like Don't Tread on Me Americans.
We're nothing fucking like that. Come on now.
insofar as if the government said, hey, you're going to like need to relocate and we're going to have to take away your guns, what would the response be? So, yeah. I don't know. I think that's to circle back to the article that we brought up, that the former prime minister's concern was if Palestinian statehood is recognized and the settlers have to move eventually and get relocated into Israel proper and leave their settlements and in some potentially disarm state versus insurgent violence within Israeli society may happen. And that's when we talk about when we talk about a potential flashpoint for civil war and civil strife.
Now, the biggest thing that I struggle with, like on an emotional level considering this, is as much as I would love to see them tear each other apart, I have a worry that in the fog of civil war, there could be pogroms committed against the Palestinian people during that time of chaos, that just like, you know, like the Tantura massacre. I'm worried about that for my own friends that live there, because if that happens during the civil war period, you know, there's going to be fanatics that are like, hey, nobody's looking at us right now. Everybody's focused on the civil war. Let's go massacre a village. That's my biggest concern. Other than that, if they could just wall off the Palestinian villages temporarily and just have the two Israeli groups just go at it,
just duke it out
and we'll eat popcorn. Great. But I'm also concerned about the Palestinian lives. So It's a conflicting thing with me. It's like at some point, man, I can't wait to see this movie. At the end point, like, oh, I don't want to see this movie, you know? So
yeah,
I'm worried.
Yeah. So I think Mark's got to go. And
I got one more. Let me say one more thing that I wrote to tie this bow tie this off. So in reference to what I just explained about the Civil War, the 1947 to 1948 Civil War in Mandatory Palestine is as much an academic war of narratives between Zionist revisionist and objective historians as it is a geopolitical and cultural battlefield between Israeli nationalism and Palestinian patriotism. Israeli Zionists cling to their nationalist version of events in pacifying the collective conscience of Israeli citizens regarding the ethnic cleansing of Palestine during the Nakba. The often cited justification for the great catastrophe inflicted on the Palestinian people is the canard that the Palestinians simply didn't want to live with the Jews, and therefore the Jews had to defend themselves. This is the most commonly used pretext in justifying any and all violence, atrocities, massacres, rapes, and torture that took place throughout these especially bloody 2 years, but it fails to take into the context that the reason for the rejection of a Zionist state was due to the violence, atrocities, massacres, rapes, and tortures which preceded the rejection of the Zionist state. So it ultimately comes down to the chicken or the egg. Zionists often simply run to the story of the egg and not the horrific chicken which fucking laid it. So anyway, there's my bow tie.
that's a great analogy. So, okay, y'all, Palestinian statehood is up next, and again ties into this hopefully digestible and easily understandable primer we did on, you know, the basic fundamentals, points of contention between two blocks of Israeli society. So that's going to be released tomorrow as Israeli Civil War Part 2. And yeah, hope to see you there. It's going to be around midday Central Time. So cheers. Hope to see you then. We've got to go, and I'm going to get this posted. So stay tuned for more at Colonial Outcasts.